Indulge in all your holiday faves this season, knowing you're getting the good stuff your body craves with Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake. It's your post-holiday recovery kit with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. And it actually tastes delicious. With 6 indulgent flavors to choose from, it's easy to make a superfood-packed shake. From chocolate, vanilla, and chai to matcha, coconut acai, and strawberry, you can even savor the season with their limited edition chocolate mint. There are endless ways to personalize your Ka'Chava, whether you prefer it straight up or enjoy adding fruit, peanut butter, nut milk, or even iced coffee. With every 2 scoops of Ka'Chava, you're getting the highest quality ingredients. No fillers, no nonsense. Holiday nutrition has never been this easy or delicious. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava, K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, and use code NEWS.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, y'all, welcome to another episode of Jesse's Fireside Chats. Today, I want to talk to you about redistricting, gambling, and the White House renovations. So, buckle your seatbelts, let's get started. So, the first thing I want to talk to you about is redistricting. We hear about it on a semi-regular basis because oftentimes states will redistrict or want to redistrict, and then the courts will get all up in a knot because the district maps are not quote-unquote diverse enough. You see, there's a portion of the Voting Rights Act that tells states they need to draw their districts to allow for proportional representation of minorities. Now, you won't be surprised to know, I think this is dumb. I don't think that race should be a major factor in politics. A lot of people clearly disagree with me because they've been injecting race into politics for decades. More on that in a second. But I don't think race should be a thing in politics because race is literally skin deep. Race is literally the first thing you see when you see somebody. You see the color of their skin. And the color of someone's skin is the stupidest way to separate people because it is so surface level. It is so superficial. It is completely beyond the person's control. And it is not something that is able to convey merit of any kind. You see, some people want you to think that your race determines your class or whatever, but it really doesn't. Your own decisions and personal responsibility, your own drive to succeed, your... Sometimes it is people you know. Sometimes it is connections. I will grant that. Sometimes what you know and who you know can both play a role. But the color of your skin in and of itself does not determine whether you will be rich or poor, whether you will live in a city or in the country, whether you will have one profession or another or no profession at all. Because it is literally skin deep. It is literally the color of your skin. Sometimes regional origins can play a role in that coloring, but even that is fading because we live in a society that is more mobile than ever before. We live in a society where a lot of people are not born in the countries their ancestors immigrated from relatively recently. And we live in a point in time where I believe over 20% of the U.S. population, at least as of one figure I saw, was foreign-born. Now, foreign-born does not necessarily determine your skin color either, but it is worth pointing out that your skin color and your country of origin are not as tied together as they once were. So even that is not necessarily determined just by your race. So race really has no meaning. It really doesn't, unless people give it artificial meaning. And that is what that is the problem. And a lot of conservatives and sometimes even other people on the left, too, will start that discussion in the 60s. But I will point out, as some on the left will point this out too, but they will only, if they do, they only focus on this period, or they try to tie what's happening now, or what they believe to be happening now, rather, back to this period. And I think those are some false equivalencies and stuff. I will say that we are not living in Jim Crow. That is obviously, we're not obviously not living in Jim Crow. That was decades ago. But I will say that even back then, race was hyper-focused on way more than it needed to be. Because what do you accomplish other than just dehumanizing an entire group of people for something they can't control? What do you accomplish by having a white-only drinking fountain? What do you accomplish by having a black-only school or a white-only school? What do you accomplish by doing that? You don't. Except to dehumanize people for no apparent reason. I will then also say that the response to that, while I can understand the intentions behind it, was not proportional. I don't think the government should be in the business of telling, of trying to outlaw racism. Racism is bad, obviously. It's a sin, because God created every race in his own image. And as I've said for like the last 2 or 3 minutes, at least, race is literally skin deep. It should not have any meaning. It's like separating people based on their hair color or their shoe size or their eye color. It's dumb. But the government should not be in the business of legally forcing the market to conform to a vision of society that judges or that forbids segregation. What I mean by that is, while segregation is morally wrong, what should have happened is instead, these businesses that segregated should have, you know, they should have been left open as is, and the market will decide even if it's at a slower pace than some would like. The market will eventually decide, you know what, we don't want to shop at these businesses that segregate anymore, because segregation is already idiotic from a free market perspective. Because if you tell an entire group of people based only on the color of their skin that they cannot come into your establishment, especially if that group of people happens to make up a significant portion of your population, you're already excluding an entire section of your would-be customer base. So you're already shooting yourself in the foot economically. And as people get, as people grow and learn and realize that segregation is dumb over the generations, eventually, even the people who would be welcome in your establishment will say, you know what? I don't want to come here anymore. I'm going to go somewhere else because I think this is dumb. I think this segregation thing is dumb. And the fact that you engage in it, I can't support that. So I'm going to go somewhere else, or I'm going to open up a competitor to you and I'm going to run you out of business. You know, that's how the free market works. It might take a few more decades than people might like, and that's sad, but that's just, it's just the way it should have gone. Because freedom of association is something the Founding Fathers supported. I believe that. And I think that when you create these policies where the government can say that because it believes you are discriminating based on race, that it can sanction or shut down your business, that gives the government more power. And you know how I feel about government power. I think the government should be as small as possible while still being functional. Not only does that give the government more power, but it allows people to attribute false motives to a business or a person or a group that is not, in fact, racist. It allows people to falsely accuse someone of being racist or segregating, and then to use that either in court to try to sue them into oblivion, or to directly report them to some agency and ruin their livelihood because of personal vendettas or a negative experience at the establishment or with the group or the individual that had nothing to do with racism. So it opens up the door for people to maliciously falsely accuse someone of racism to ruin their life. And I don't think that that's good. I don't support that. And in a similar way, I do not think the government should be in the business of telling states how to draw their districts. I think that the drawing of districts should be simple, self-explanatory, basically. It should be based only on population. You know, you have a limited number of seats that the whole country to work with, so you can't draw too many congressional districts. But you also know that you need to make your districts so that a fair number of people are represented. What is that number? Well, that varies from state to state. Some states are more populous than others, as we know. California's got like 50 million people and Wyoming has like 12. Some states are more urban or more rural than others, which can determine what makes the most logical sense when drawing a district. Some states have different partisan makeups. Some are more liberal, some are more conservative, and a very much dwindling few are quote-unquote purple states, meaning they're kind of in the middle. Or they're toss-up, or they don't evenly lean one way or the other as much. They can vary from election cycle to election cycle more than is to be expected, and enough to where they don't really lean consistently, if that makes sense. Because of the increasing polarization of our politics, the number of purple states is decreasing, and purple districts too, but they are still a thing. And so, you know, a lot of those factors can determine the number and shape of districts, but they all boil down to population. So, you know, that should be the main consideration. Race should not be, because as I said, race is the dumbest way to separate people. It's literally skin deep. So you should not have to draw your district map based on that. I understand that a district that is 200 miles wide by 300 miles long might be normal in a place like Alaska, where everyone's super spread out and very few people live there because most of us don't like to freeze. But when your district artificially stretches across half your state, like in Louisiana, that's a problem. Especially when there are more logical ways to lay out your district. It would also be one thing if your state is half desert. So you have large stretches where not a lot of people live, and so your district covers one district covers half your state. Or if your state's population is so low that you only get one representative. In that case, I guess you wouldn't really have congressional districts. You might have more local districts, but those are different. But if you're if your state could be drawn in a more logically consistent way that does not require artificially combining half your state into one district, specifically to cater towards specific racially oriented laws, you know, then the state should be able to draw the districts in the most logical way. Because otherwise, you're just creating, you're not only creating confusion, but you're also artificially tampering with the votes. You're artificially tampering with, you know, if democracy is supposed to be based on the will of the people, which I know we're not a direct democracy, but if democracy is supposed to be based on the will of the people, then these laws tamper with that. So they literally tamper with democracy. They make things less democratic than they otherwise would be. Now, I will acknowledge too that gerrymandering has been a thing pretty much since this country has been a thing. The term actually came from the name of one of the founding fathers, generation, Elbridge Gerry, which I don't know a whole lot about what he did or who he was. I just know he was one of the members of that generation, and the term comes from him. I believe he was from like Connecticut or somewhere like that. He was somewhere in New England. And so I will acknowledge that that's always been a thing. And I will get to what I propose as a solution to that here in a second. But the other thing I want to say about telling states how to draw their districts based on race is when you do that, you are implicitly assuming that members of a certain race will vote a certain way. You are assuming that they will vote one way just because of the color of their skin. And that is insulting. It's a shame that more people don't feel insulted by that, especially people in that demographic. Because it is one thing to just say the statistics, this percent of people voted for this candidate in 2012, or that percent of people voted for that candidate in the 2024 election, or whatever it is. Like, if you're just saying the actual statistics of how people vote, that's not insulting. What is insulting is when you assume that because someone has this characteristic, they can't help, like, you know, being black or white or Asian or being a woman or a man, because whichever gender you're born as, that's what you are. Sorry, not sorry. When you assume that someone will vote one way or the other just because of those types of characteristics, you're insulting that person. You're insulting their intelligence. You're insulting you're insulting their ability to think for themselves. You're belittling, you're diminishing any experiences that might determine political affiliation. Because just because someone is a member of one race or another, or a man or a woman, does not mean they'll have the same experiences and the same reactions to those experiences. You know, it, as I said before, your race does not determine in and of itself whether you'll be rich or poor, whether you'll live in a city or in the country, whether you'll have a good relationship with your family or not, whether you'll have a good relationship with God or not, because it's literally just your skin color. It doesn't determine those things. Those things are determined by other circumstances in your life. And so when someone assumes that you will vote a certain way just because of your skin color and nothing else, they're insulting you because they're lumping you in with other people who happen to share that same characteristic with you, but might have totally different experiences. and totally different ways of reacting. Because even if you have the same experience as someone else, you can react to it totally differently than they do. And that can shape how you view the world. So, you know, drawing districts based on race is insulting to entire groups of people. So if we're supposed to be about compassion and trying to build a more compassionate, more understanding, more unified society, I would think that would be something you'd want to avoid. And so a lot of times too, in addition to race, and this is something the courts don't get as all up in a knot about, a lot of times theoretical partisan advantage is considered in drawing these lines, because these commissions that draw the districts may say they are unbiased, they may say they're nonpartisan, but as I've said before, an unbiased human is as common as a vegan cat. It does not exist. Find me one, and you'll probably become famous, because you'll have discovered something that was previously not believed to have existed. It'd be like if you discovered a unicorn. If you were in the woods and you suddenly saw a unicorn running around, and it was not somebody who put a plastic horn on their horse to pull a prank. If it was an actual living unicorn, farted rainbows and everything, you'd probably become famous, because, you know, unicorns, as far as any of us know, are not real. And so in the same way, or like if you found a cat just happily eating grass and nothing else and living a completely happy, healthy life, you know, you'd become famous, because you would have discovered something that as of right now does not appear to exist. Because for those who may be unfamiliar, cats are what is called obligate carnivores, meaning they have to eat meat because they need a nutrient called taurine. I actually looked this up because I was curious a while back. They need a nutrient called taurine, and they can only get it from eating meat. So if you try to make a cat go vegan, which some people sadly have tried to do that, you will cause your cat to have health problems. Which is why I say that a vegan cat is not something you will naturally find. Just like all humans are going to have some kind of bias. I did a whole episode, I believe, on this. I know I've at least done segments on it, so if you want to hear my take on that in more depth, you can feel free to check any of those out. But as I was saying, an unbiased human is as common as a vegan cat. So any commission that claims to be unbiased or nonpartisan, even elections that claim they are nonpartisan, they're not really, because every person has leanings. So every person will act based on those leanings, even if they say they try not to. Those will come into play to some degree or another. It may be less so than if they're openly partisan, but it will still be a thing. It will still happen. Because no human is truly unbiased. It is impossible. Which means that any commission that is tasked with drawing districts is going to be inherently biased, one way or the other. And so any districts that are drawn by humans will inherently have some sort of partisan considerations in mind, in their design, but that's just the way it will be. Now, I have proposed before, and I will propose again, a solution to this. We could have AI draw the districts. I will grant that the algorithms can be biased. They can be, because again, humans are programming them. And what did I just say about unbiased humans and vegan cats? So I will grant that AI can be biased. However, comma, AI is very good at reading patterns, looking at data, generating things quickly, it cost effectively, efficiently. So what we could do is, I understand we'll still need a census every 10 years, but the census is prone to errors. And so if you draw districts based on that, knowing full well that some people don't participate in the census, some people die every day, people are born every day, illegals sometimes get counted in the census. There are sometimes just plain errors in the census, because anything that big is going to have errors in it. Like, that's just the nature of it. So if you draw districts based on this faulty data, you know, you're going to end up with faulty districts, even without partisan bias. And so what I propose is that while we'll still need a census for other things, like for infrastructure purposes, so we could still keep it for that, what we should do for districts is, instead, every 4 years after the presidential election is finalized, all the districts around the country, for at least for the congressional level, should be redrawn. Now, local districts should be drawn as the community sees fit, if they want to base it on the census or whatever they want to do. But when it comes to the congressional districts, those should be drawn right after the presidential election is finalized. We feed the data into the AI, the amount of registered voters in each district, the partisan affiliation, if any, or the presidential candidate, how many votes each presidential candidate got. That'd probably be more helpful, honestly, because some states make you declare a party, some base your party status on your primary vote, and some have other ways of doing that, because some have, like, closed primaries, some have ranked choice primaries. It's very different from state to state. So instead of trying to go that route of seeing what the affiliation is of everyone, we instead look at what percentage of each community, each county, or each, like, would-be district voted for which candidate. And then you draw the districts accordingly, having the AI do it, having the AI draw a district map based on solely on population and the election results. And that way, you're not basing it off of theoretical partisan advantage. You're basing it on actual partisan advantage, because you're looking at which party's candidate got which percentage of the vote. And using that to determine that, along with population, to determine how the districts will look. And so you will end up with congressional representatives that are more likely to actually align with the population's values. And it discourages people from artificially tinkering with the lines to make them, quote-unquote, more diverse. And it keeps the districts up to date, because when you only draw them every 10 years, they become stuffy and outdated. Versus if they're drawn every 4 years, well, then they actually show the changing views of the population, or the lack thereof. They actually capture what that population's needs and values are in the moment more accurately. And because AI is drawing the districts, the AI is less biased than a commission would be. It also probably costs a lot less, and it can spit out a map in a few seconds rather than weeks or months. And so it's a lot more cost effective and a lot more time efficient as well. So the district drawing process, the redistricting process would make a lot more sense that way. It would be a lot more streamlined, and it would have a lot less confusion in it. So those are my thoughts on that. The only other thing I want to say about districts and representatives is this. I'm torn on whether we should continue to have the 435 cap on House representatives. There's no serious initiative that I know of right now to change it or to maintain it. And we've had it for about a century. I believe it was codified in the 20s. I know it was sometime in the early 1900s. We learned about that in one of my classes in college. But I can understand wanting to cap the amount of congressmen and the amount of districts, because even now it can be kind of confusing as to committee assignments and trying to tabulate all those votes can take a long time, even with electronic voting, and you know, having to swear all those people in already takes forever as it is. There are a lot of logistical limitations you would have with continuing to expand the amount of congressmen. I mean, the Capitol building itself only has so much space for everybody. So I understand all of that. However, the amount of districts that we have means that representation is extremely diluted. I mean, I've already said that the congressmen only represent us in theory a lot of times, because while we're whispering in one ear, they have interest groups, lobbyists, party leadership, and other voices yelling in their other ear, drowning us out. So it's already hard to convey our actual wants and needs to the people that are supposed to represent us. But it's especially difficult to do that even without those other voices, because representation itself is extremely diluted, probably far beyond what the Founding Fathers would have wanted. Now, I did the math, and if you were to assume, there is going to be a lot of assuming here, but if you were to assume that the population of the U.S., for the sake of round numbers, is 330 million people, and if you were to then take that and you were to assume that each congressman had an equal number of constituents, which I know is not the case, but just bear with me here. If you take 330 million and you divide it by 435, what you get is 758,620 point something 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 people. It's like 0.51 something something something. It's a laundry list of decimals. So since we can't have a fractional person, can't have half a person, then let's assume that that means that we round that to 758,621 constituents. That's a lot of constituents. That's over 750,000 people. That's bigger than the population of some states, like Wyoming and... According to Google, the population of Wyoming is about 586,485. And the population of Vermont is about 647,818. So the amount of constituents that each representative would have if representation was equally, if the amount of constituents that each representative had was equal, would be bigger than the population of at least those two states. I didn't even look at what's the 48th least populous state or 48th most populous state. But just that those numbers alone should concern you. That we send people to Congress who are supposed to represent local constituents, but even if representation was equally apportioned, the congressmen would each still represent a number of constituents whose population is bigger than that of entire states. You know, if you're truly supportive of representative democracy and small government liberty that the founding fathers intended, that should concern you. What should the number be? What should the right number be? I don't know, but it should probably be smaller than that. So what should the number of congressmen be? I don't know either. I don't have a strong opinion about this, but it is worth considering, because when the Constitution was signed, the U.S. population, according to Google, was approximately 3.9 million people, not even 4 million. Now, granted, not all of those people could vote, because some of them were enslaved, some of them were women who couldn't vote at the time, some of them were children who couldn't vote and still can't. I believe you had to be 21 to vote. I know that was at least the case for a very long time, because around the time of the Vietnam War, people argued rightly that you shouldn't be able to be drafted into a war where you could potentially get killed, and not be able to vote for or against the people who would be sending you into that war. And so they argued for lowering the voting age to 18, which I think is good, and I do not think we should lower it to any younger than that, because even 18-year-olds are not great at making decisions, but we have to determine legal adulthood somewhere. We can't say you're 47 years old and still not great at, and still not legal adult, because you might decide to run headfirst into trees at full speed. But we do have to draw that line somewhere, but I do think 18 is a good place to draw it. I do not think we should have 16-year-olds voting. But where was I? So, back then, the number of representatives in Congress was 59 representatives. I looked it up, and Google says that, quote, during George Washington's presidency, the United States Congress had a total of 59 representatives, end quote. So what that means is that for a population of 4 million, or no, 3.9 million, but almost 4 million, there were 59 representatives. So if you do the math, that means that during George Washington's presidency, the average representative would have represented 66,101.7 people, or 66,102 people. Now, I will grant that number is going based off of the population when the Constitution itself was signed, which is still an approximate estimation, and that it does include the representatives themselves. However, comma, that still means that each representative represented approximately 66,000 people on average. Again, constituency numbers were not equal, just like now, but that still means that representation was a lot less diluted than it is now. If we had a representative for every 66,000 people, then Congress would have approximately 5,000 representatives. Now, I know that's a lot, but that means that representation would not be nearly as diluted. So, I don't, obviously that's not one of my main concerns in politics right now, but I did want to throw that out there as something to consider, especially for people that claim to be all about democracy and the people and we the people and all that. Just something to consider. Okay, moving on. Next thing I want to get to is the White House renovations. So Trump promised to build a ballroom. I believe he was promising that even months ago, but Trump promised to build a ballroom in the White House. I will say that the messaging around this has not always been consistent. And while inconsistent messaging is something we've had a lot in government, that does not mean it's a good thing. I do think that politicians need to be more consistent about what they're doing. I understand things can change, but for something like a ballroom, something that you have to put in time and planning into, it's not something you just wake up and build one day, I would think you would know all along what your plan was, and if that is the case, that you would say what that plan is. I thought we were supposed to be about transparency. So that's not a great look. I will also say that I understand if the timing to start construction was already pre-planned. I don't know if it was or not. I have not researched that. But I will say that even if it was, I would think that knowing we've been in a government shutdown, I say it's a partial stoppage, but y'all like call it a shutdown, so I guess we'll call it that for the last several weeks. And that some people are worrying, rightly about how they're going to eat, how they're going to get health insurance or have health insurance, in the near future, you know, knowing all of that, starting the construction now on this ballroom, even if it is covered by donations, it's still not a great look. Like, I would think that you would at least, I don't know, wait a few weeks, wait for all this to be hashed out, because it's just not a great look. You know, I don't really have a huge opinion one way or the other about the actual project itself, but doing it now doesn't seem like the best look. Even if you're using donation money to cover it instead of taxpayer money. Also, the fact that he said originally that the East Wing, you know, was not going to be disrupted, and then he said it was only going to be part of it, and now it's the whole thing. You know, that's the very inconsistency I was talking about a second ago. And I just don't think that politicians should use this kind of inconsistent messaging. I think people would trust government at least a little bit more if government was more transparent about what it's actually doing. Instead of being vague and wishy-washy and dishonest. Now, I still don't have a firm opinion about this particular project. I will say that I do think the government should be a lot smaller than it is, and it does a lot of things that are not necessarily its job. Or should not necessarily be its job, in my view. So transparency alone would not automatically make me love everything that government does every day. But I just think that some of the ways that Trump has been handling this whole ballroom project are not necessarily great. Okay, moving on. The last thing I want to talk about is gambling. And I'm not going to spend a terribly long time on this, because my thoughts on gambling are pretty simple. It's stupid. It's a stupid way to spend your money. I don't know if the government should necessarily ban it, because one, what have I said about government? Two, you know, we had a long time where gambling was illegal, and people who still wanted to gamble would do so with outlets and with individuals who used unsavory tactics, knowing that that people wouldn't have much recourse, because, I mean, if they called the police and said that they'd been cheated or stolen from or whatever, the police might also arrest them for gambling. So, I mean, I'm not sure if the ban on gambling was very effective. I still think gambling is a very sinful and stupid thing to do. I'll get to that in a second. But I'm not sure if we should ban it. I do think as communities, we should discourage it, definitely. We should not encourage it. And it is annoying that when I'm trying to watch YouTube, I get all these stupid ads for these betting sites. I don't care. I like sports. I do not care about gambling. I have no interest in gambling. And I do think that the lottery is really dumb, because you know, your chances of winning are worse than your chances of being struck by lightning. And a lot of times the people who play it are people who are already suffering. And so even if you win, I don't know how you can sleep at night knowing that all those other people are suffering and starving, or at least a chunk of them are. And also, you know, the government takes a huge percentage of your winnings anyway. And then on top of that, a lot of the winners, not all, but a lot of them end up doing really dumb things with the money they win. They end up wasting it. So I think a lot of this gambling stuff is dumb. The fact that people get addicted to it and think that it's a reliable way to make income is also both tragic and dumb. I mean, it's dumb that they think they can reliably win it back or reliably make money on it. And it's tragic that they get addicted to it. And sometimes destroy their lives, their families, their relationships over it. Sometimes even commit crimes to fund their addiction. Any addiction that causes people to do that is tragic. And it always starts with a choice. So the people who say it's a choice are partially right. But it often, I'm not sure if it's a disease, but it often does turn into a condition. A disease and a condition are two different things. A disease is a condition, but not every condition is a disease. It's not like if I sneeze on you, it's not like if a gambling addict sneezes on you, you're suddenly going to start gambling. Like, a disease would be if I have the flu and I cough on you, you get the flu because I gave you the flu because it's a disease. But a condition, you know, that is a condition, but gambling addiction and drug addiction and things like that, those are conditions. They're not diseases. The only kind of gray area there would be that sometimes babies whose moms use drugs while pregnant can be born with addictions. So I guess in that case, that can act like a disease, but gambling addiction doesn't. It's not like if your mom gambles while you're pregnant, you're going to start gambling. Like, but the point is, God wants us to have stewardship. God wants us to be stewards of what he gives us. He wants us to manage our finances responsibly. Now, I will grant that we all have a weakness of some sort. Mine is food. And So I will grant that sometimes we don't always use everything he gives us as responsibly as we probably should. But gambling is a very particularly dumb way to waste what God has given you. And so you're being a particularly bad steward when you gamble. Because most of the time, you're throwing money away. And even if you win, you are not only receiving your own money, but somebody else's money for work you didn't do. Like, if you won a game, even if you won a game, that's not really work. You didn't really, I mean, I guess you sort of earned that, but even then, there was chance involved, so I'm not sure if that's necessarily great. But it's even worse when it's the type of gambling, like, you know, lottery, where you really did not earn it. You really didn't do anything to deserve it. You just bought a ticket, but you didn't really, it's not like you went to work all day. It's not like you helped care for someone that was sick, or it's not like you created a product that everybody loved and everybody bought. It's not like you sold a piece of land and got money for that. Because even in that case, you kind of earned that money, because you have decided to part with an asset that you had before. And so, if the sale happened fair and square, then you receive that money fair and square. Especially if the person who gave you that money, also didn't go rob a bank or do something else that is illegal and dishonest to get the money to pay you for the land. Now if they did, you know, that'd be one thing. But where was I going with this? Well, what I was saying is that gambling, when you gamble, especially when it is the type of, like, betting on something that you have no direct part in, like your team winning or losing, or, you know, another sports team winning or losing, a team that you do not play on, you do not coach, you do not have any direct effect on whether they win or lose. You're just betting one way or the other. You have no control over that. So, you know, you didn't really earn any money. You do win, and if you lose, you're throwing money away. And same thing with a lottery. You're not working or buying or selling or doing anything to actually deserve that money. You're just receiving winnings from, you know, your ticket that you bought and all the other people who bought tickets too and who are now suffering because they threw their money away and now you have it. Like, that's dumb. It's not great. You may as well, from a stewardship perspective, you may as well just take a bunch of money, throw it in a blender, and then pour the resulting puree down the drain. It's wasteful, and it's wasteful for pretty much all involved, and it is inconsiderate for you to take all of that because you want it. While all the other people who played lost, and many of them are low income and are now even in worse shape than they were before, may actually be starving. So, in short, I think that gambling is dumb. You shouldn't do it. We shouldn't encourage it as a community, as a society. Should it be illegal? I'm conflicted. Because on the one hand, it's sinful and it doesn't contribute anything. But on the other hand, you know, my thoughts on the size of government. I am a conservatarian. I think we should have a very small government. So I'm not inclined to think that a lot of things should be illegal. So, I mean, if a community wants to outlaw it and the people really want that, then I guess that's one thing. But federally, I don't know. I don't think so. I also understand that when you make gambling illegal, as was the case for decades, people who truly want to do it, they've gone to sources that use dishonest tactics, knowing full well that their customers can't get, don't have a lot of recourse because, those customers could be arrested for gambling or could be fined for it or could face any other punishments for it by reporting anything that was done to them, like if they were stolen from, while engaging in it. It's the same issue we have when it comes to the war on drugs. Drugs are sinful. We should not encourage the use of drugs. Obviously, drugs don't really... They don't benefit society in any way. But when it comes to outlawing them, continuing to have them be illegal, I am very conflicted because they're destructive and sinful and nobody should use them, yes. But people still do. And so we still have an addiction problem in our society. We still have an epidemic of addiction. People's lives are still being destroyed by these things. And sometimes it's harder for those people to get help because of the way that some of the laws are. So I don't know. I don't know. I don't think there is one best answer. But I do think that, I do think that these are things that God obviously does not want people to engage in. So obviously I can't condone them and I don't think we should encourage them. I think we should discourage them socially as communities and as a society. But legally speaking, I don't know what the best answer is. Because sometimes banning something does not automatically make it go away. There are some who want you to think that it does, but it really doesn't. That's just the way it is. So, thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode or considered it to be food for thought. You can find this podcast on Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, the RSS feed, iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, and Pandora. You can also email us at jessesfiresidechats@gmail.com. That's JESSEAS, firesidechats@gmail.com. You can also contact us on our Facebook page at Jesse's Fireside Chats and on X at JFSCpod. And you can also feel free to pass this along to anybody you know that might be interested. And no pressure, but if you'd like to leave a small donation to help support us, we'd appreciate it. Ko-fi.com/Jesse's Fireside Chats. That's ko-fi.com/Jesse's Fireside Chats. Please come back next time. And if you want to be a guest, feel free to reach out to us. And have a blessed day.